Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 10th. Today's session is entitled, Who's Allowed to Write About the Holocaust? Presented by Kathy Schwinn, number SCK-2006-05. Let's listen in.
We'll start with a sort of catch-all. My name is Kata, and when I am not here at Holden, I live in Iowa City, where I just finished studying creative writing at the Iowa Writers Workshop, and I will be teaching at Augustana College in Rock Island, Illinois this coming fall, which I'm thrilled about. So welcome. I'm glad that all of you came, and I'm excited to discuss what we're going to be working with today. The joy for me of teaching at Holden is, first of all, that before when I've taught, it's been at University of Iowa, University of Montana, and so I don't really get to bring, many of my questions about poetry are often very closely related to questions about faith, and to intertwine a great deal in a number of different ways. And those aren't questions that I usually get to ask as much in a university setting. So the joy for me is that I get to come up here with all these questions that I have and turn them right over to you so that I can get some answers. So, and for those of you who have been to Holden before or not been here before, I just like to remind people at the beginning of each of these classes that it's a Holden discussion, and so not only are all viewpoints welcome, but sort of needed. And so I want to hear from all of you, and debate and things like that are good. Hi, Bill. Come on in.
Thank you.
So today we're going to be looking at two poets who in some way use the Holocaust in their poetry, or in the certain poem that we'll be looking at today. And so what we're going to do first is just read through each of the poems, and then I'm going to ask the question, how is each poet using the Holocaust? You'll see as we read the poems that it's a different use of the Holocaust in each one. How is it being used? And then, how many of you know or have read Sylvia Plath before? Anyone? A couple? How about Paul Celan? Anyone? A little bit? Okay. For those of you who do have biographical understandings of each of the poets, I'm going to ask you for the first part here, for the first readings, to sort of put those aside. And I'm going to ask you, how is each poet using the Holocaust? And then I'm going to ask you, just based on the poems, why you think each poet might be using the Holocaust. And then we'll do another question after that. But just as we're reading them the first time, sort of have those in the back of your mind. Okay. So I'm going to pass around. There's two poems here. One is called Death Fugue, and one is called Dead. So I'll send them around separately, but make sure you get a copy of each.
Chew. Daddy, I have had to kill you. You died before I had time. Marble heavy, a bag full of God. Ghastly statue with one gray toe, big as a Frisco seal, and a head in the freakish Atlantic where it pours bean green over blue in the waters off beautiful Nauset. I used to pray to recover you. Ach, du. In the German tongue, in the Polish town, straight flat by the roller of wars, wars, wars. But the name of the town is common. My Polak friend says there are a dozen or two. So I never could tell where you put your foot, your root. I never could talk to you. The tongue stuck in my jaw. It stuck in the barbed wire snare. Ich, ich, ich. Ich. I could hardly speak. I thought every German was you, and the language obscene, an engine chuffing me off like a Jew to Dachau, Auschwitz, Belsen. I began to talk like a Jew. I think I may well be a Jew. The snows of the Tyrol, the clear beer of Vienna, are not very pure or true. With my gypsy ancestress, and my weird luck, and my Taroque pack, and my Taroque pack, I may be a bit of a Jew. I have always been scared of you, with your Luftwaffe, your gobbledygoo, and your neat mustache, and your Aryan eye, bright blue. Panzerman, Panzerman, oh you. Not God, but a swastika, so black no sky could squeak through. Every woman adores a fascist, the boot in the face, the brute, brute heart of a brute like you. You stand at the blackboard, Daddy, in the picture I have of you, a cleft in your chin instead of your foot, but no less a devil for that. No, not any less the black man who bit my pretty red heart in two. I was 10 when they buried you. At 20, I tried to die and get back, back, back to you. I thought even the bones would do. But they pulled me out of the sack and they stuck me together with glue. And then I knew what to do. I made a model of you, a man in black with a Mein Kampf look and a love of the rack and the screw, and I said, I do, I do. So, Daddy, I'm finally through. The black telephone's off at the root. The voices just can't worm through. If I've killed one man, I've killed two. The vampire who said he was you and drank my blood for a year, 7 years if you want to know. Daddy, you can lie back now. There's a stake in your fat black heart and the villagers never liked you. They are dancing and stamping on you. They always knew it was you. Daddy, Daddy, you bastard, I'm through.
Thank you. Sort of keep that on one side of your brain, and then let's look at Death Fume. I'll read this one. Death Fume. Black milk of daybreak, we drink it at sundown. We drink it at noon in the morning, we drink it at night. We drink it and we drink it. We dig a grave in the breezes, there one lies unconfined. A man lives in the house, he plays with the serpents, he writes. He writes when dusk falls to Germany, your golden hair, Marguerite. He writes it and steps out of doors, and the stars are flashing. He whistles his pack out, he whistles his Jews out in the earth, has them dig for a grave. He commands us strike up for the dance. Black milk of daybreak, we drink you at night. We drink in the morning, at noon, we drink you at sundown. We drink and we drink you. A man lives in the house, he plays with the serpents, he writes. He writes when dusk falls to Germany, your golden hair, Marguerite, your ashen hair, Schulenith. We dig a grave in the breezes, there one lies unconfined. He calls out, jab deeper into the earth, you lot, you others, sing now and play. He grabs at the iron in his belt, he waves it, his eyes are blue. Jab deeper, you lot, with your spades, you others, play on for the dance. Black milk of daybreak, we drink you at night. We drink you at noon in the morning, we drink you at sundown.
We drink and we drink you. A man lives in the house, your golden hair, Marguerite, your ashen hair, Shulamith. He plays with the serpents. He calls out more sweetly, play death. Death is a master from Germany. He calls out more darkly, now stroke your strings, then in smoke you will rise into air, then a grave you will have in the clouds, there one lies unconfined. Black milk of daybreak, we drink you at night. We drink you at noon, death is a master from Germany. We drink you at sundown, and in the morning we drink and we drink you. Death is a master from Germany, his eyes are blue. He strikes you with leaden bullets, his aim is true. A man lives in the house, your golden hair, Marguerite. He sets his pack onto us, he grants us a grave in the air. He plays with the serpents and daydreams, death is a master from Germany. Your golden hair, Marguerite, your ashen hair, Shulamith.
So both of these are quite intense points. Just admit that right away. They are certainly doing some different things, though. So let's just sort of brainstorm. We'll kind of make two lists here. How is the Holocaust being used in each of these poems? What are some of the differences? You can also throw out just differences you notice about form, about how things look, any, just anything that sort of comes to mind. Or maybe let's start with the Paul Celan poem, the Death Fugue, and talk about what the setting of that seems to be. Where do you feel like you are?
Concentration
camp, okay. So you really feel like you're physically sort of in the middle of the Holocaust. It's sort of going on around you. And how about with Daddy? And there's not right or wrong answers here. But do you feel, for instance, do you feel like you're in the middle of a camp, concentration camp in Daddy? Are there moments when you do? What do you feel like?
I feel like Daddy was the bad guy.
Daddy was the bad guy.
For what he's done.
Okay, so.
I don't know where you are. Not
in a concentration camp. Instead, the enemy has shifted more to this Daddy figure. Mm-hmm. Okay. Anybody else want to say anything about like setting or where it feels that we are?
I feel like it's in the city, if it's not the ghetto in Poland, or at least in maybe Warsaw or some. They're not in the camp, but the stuff is all around them, happening is all around them.
Yeah, we travel through a lot. We get Poland. And we get what other places are brought up, place names.
Auschwitz.
Auschwitz, yep.
Vienna.
So we get
the freakish Atlantic.
The what?
The freakish Atlantic.
Atlantic, so ocean, yep. Where else? Anything?
Vienna.
We get a Frisco seal in there too, San Francisco. Sort of just she covers a lot of ground and a lot of sort of time too. So the setting is way more sort of, although we kind of go back to concentration camp locations, certainly, it's more fragmented and we don't feel like we're sitting there through the whole poem, right? Yeah.
The death fugue, it feels like a literal place or a geographical place. This to me, Daddy seemed like a relational, or it's just when you
Great.
Access it, it feels
Great.
Like in relationship. That's
that's a great way to describe it. Relational versus physical space, yeah. And so if in Death Fugue, we know that the Holocaust, at the very least, is being used as a physical setting for the poem. How is the Holocaust being used in Daddy? What's she doing with it? Why is it in there?
It seems like it's a constant reminder. It's just kind of returning and coming back.
Yeah, yeah, and why do you think
why does it feel like it's there? What does it have to do?
My feeling is that Vindeyati is kind of moving away from the Holocaust, and it's just kind of one of those things that it's still always with you.
Okay, so it's sort of historically just still on the poet's radar, and thus is sort of, she's going to pull from there because it's present with her still, mm-hmm. sort of. So just a sort of, this is her historical or political context that she's writing from, and it's around, so it seeps into the writing, yeah.
I get the sense from the poet from Dan is that it's a sense of shame.
Shame, okay. Say more about
she's
that.
She's trying to escape it, can't escape it, or is disturbed by what happened, even though she was not a victim in the sense that the death view author was.
Okay, so she is... So, at some level here, she's comparing her dad to a Nazi officer, right? So there's this comparison and a sense of victimization that's being... that she is a victim, and she's comparing her victimhood to the victimhood of another group of people. Would you say that? Or no,
what it feels like to me.
You'd say comparison between daddy, the daddy figure, and the Nazi officer, yes?
Yeah, but it was like, the sense I get is that it was a disillusioned relationship, not one that turned out the way she had maybe originally hoped it would.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Certainly, if you're going to compare your father to a Nazi officer, there's going to be some disillusionment.
I like the word shame.
And shame, yes, great. And what else? Yeah.
My gut response to both of these was, in Daddy, I felt that she was trying to find a way to live with it.
A way to live with it, okay.
And in Death View, I felt that the enemy was well-defined.
Was well-defined?
Yeah, so it was very obvious who the enemy was. And as we said, it was a physical rather than a relational kind of thing. No room for muddy waters here.
Okay. So this... the trying to find a way to live with it is also... So she's kind of using the Holocaust imagery then as a way to sort of clarify her own feelings, to make it more clear what she's... to clarify the relationship.
I get a feeling she doesn't know who she is. She's okay. She's got this father who is not Nazi-like, but she's like a liberal with an extremely authoritarian father, and she's confused.
Great. Any other final thoughts kind of before I ask my next question? Yeah.
I mean, it's so... the relationship is described to say she feels like a Holocaust victim in relationship to... I mean, that's about as strong as you can get.
Yes. Okay, and that actually segues perfectly into the next question, which is... that both of these poets, and I'm going to, after we talk about this question, we'll go into the actual biographical info of both of them, but both poets, this poem in particular for each of them, they were criticized by critics, shockingly enough, for this poem in particular. And so why do you think they were? You're sort of on to it there, Bill, in terms of... the victimhood and the question of, well, is having a sort of crappy relationship with your dad the same as being a prisoner in a concentration camp? Like, is that a fair metaphor?
It's an interesting topic. I mentioned that book, Constantine's Sword, in the earlier session, but it's really about the question is who has the right to write about this issue.
Yes.
And we're all right. But basically, it's the argument is it's appropriated. So that unique Holocaust or Shoah situation has been appropriated in ways that I think Jewish folks sometimes will even our disaster is stolen from us.
Yeah. Okay.
In a way, it's just not authentic.
So it's.
And further, almost in a way, deepens the reality itself, or kind of participates in making them victims once more. It's deep in. I hadn't thought of these things.
Great. Any other reasons you can think of why people would have been critical of this poem, either of the poems? How about Death View? That's a little bit more tricky of why people. It's more of an aesthetic reason. As I was reading the Death Fugue, what did you just sort of notice about the lines or about the poem or about how it felt to hear it?
It goes over and over.
Yeah. There's a lot of repetition, the use of the, I don't know if there's any experts here on fugues as a musical composition. Do people know a lot about that? Or
yeah.
And I know next to nothing, but mostly I know that fugues have to do with themes being repeated again and again throughout the musical pieces. So you see how within this poem, right, it's being repeated. Yeah.
Well, when I was kind of feeling the reading of it, it seems to me that it's a statement about, or I was saying it's a statement about Germany, and almost a fear art is a statement that there is this repetition where it's like permanently staying. That's the feeling I got about it. So actually the idea of fugue and repetition of theme makes sense in that.
Yes,
in
absolutely.
I can't point to it. I get a feeling that I'm not sure who it's directed to. I get a feeling almost that this is very accusatory. It's very and I'm not saying it's wrong, but I get a feeling it looks like it's written to people who had the experience, but I really think it's not. I think it's directed to us. Mm-hmm. As to this is what we've gone through, and it repeats.
I keep thinking of the German here. She talks about her eyes are blue. You know, blonde. I was thinking blonde, blue-eyed, good-looking Germans here. How can they betray you?
How can they be what?
Betray you so?
Oh.
You know, betray. They are doing this to us. Why?
Yes. Great.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, all this darkness and blackness, and but there's always your golden hair, Marguerite.
So there's some beautiful imagery there too that gets filtered in. And how about just the in terms of if you were going to think about books of the Bible? And just listen, instead of listening to the content of the words, listen to the rhythm of what I'm going to read and tell me if it reminds you of any books from the Bible. He writes, when dusk falls to Germany, your golden hair, Marguerite. He writes it and steps out of doors and the stars are flashing. He whistles his pack out. What, does that remind you of anything? Eunice, you're nodding a little bit.
I was nodding in time to the rhythm.
Yeah.
It's almost song-like.
Song-like, yes. Yep.
Crazy.
right? That sort of, I mean, it's not exact, but that sort of the cadences of rhythm, these sort of long lines that carry you on and on, and we don't have any punctuation, right? So, and we have this repetition, but one image gets carried into the next, and into the next, and into the next, and we're not sort of given a break, and nor are we told how the images relate to one another always, because there's not this punctuation. So, the point of all of this, some of the stuff in the golden hair Marguerite and this sort of song-like rhythms. So Paul Celan, who wrote Death Fugue, was criticized because people thought that he was making the experience in a concentration camp too beautiful. That he was aestheticizing something that was so horrible. And how could you take something that was so horrible and make it beautiful to read?
I mean, just the form, just the fact that it was well done.
I'm not saying that. I'm just giving you what the criticism was. I'm not.
The movie Life is Beautiful, he got criticized for the same thing.
Sure.
In the aesthetic beauty of the movie. Yeah.
Which goes back to, and we'll sort of return to the largest question, sort of circling all of this, which is, you know, who's allowed to make a movie like that? Who are the people that are allowed to do this, as Bill was saying? But also, how are there restrictions on how it can be done? That, for instance, that people thought that this was too beautiful. If you're going to do it, you shouldn't be putting in this flowery language. You shouldn't have these beautiful song-like cadences. You should, you know, it should sound the way that it felt. Does that make sense? So that sort of, we'll kind of return to that a little bit. I want to give you just some background on the lives of these poets, because I think that is really interesting too. And then we'll return to Daddy and look at that just a little bit more closely. I'm going to go a little bit more specifically into Sylvia Plath than I will to Paul Celan. And others here may be able to add more, because I'm not an expert on either of these poets, but so feel free to raise your hand and jump in.
Can you spell Sylvia or write down?
Yes.
It's not on that.
I know that it's not. This happened with all of my photocopying accidents last week. I didn't do it myself, and I usually write it on somebody else's entry. So yes.
Do you have a word to say about why you chose those two people?
Why I chose these two poems?
Yeah. Or how you decided that they had anything to do
with each other.
Something together.
That's a good question. It's fun for me before I come to Holden, because the joy of getting to teach here and getting offered to teach here is that you have a lot of freedom in what you get to teach. So I basically took all of my books and all of my poems that I liked that I haven't gotten to look at as closely as I wanted to, and start sort of pulling them out and seeing which ones might connect to each other or talk to each other in different ways. And I think that the Holocaust is such a sensitive issue, and so it connected to me a lot with kind of like what was brought up in Bible study this morning, sort of like the violence of our world, things that are going on. And as I talk about Sylvia Plath, you'll see even more why it's interesting to me. But and I think I believe more than anything else that looking closely at poems and literature and getting into this and finding, just digging deeper for how we talk about these things, asking the questions of who gets to talk about them and how we do it is what can save us, literally, very physically. So that sort of things. Okay, so Sylvia Plath was born on October 27th, 1932. And her father, whose name was Otto Plath, was a biology professor at Boston University, and he was an expert on bees, which I think is so interesting. Bee expert. And so from ages about four. What did we say?
I said bees are in big trouble.
Bees are in. Are they?
Yeah, I mean, there's an environmental catastrophe.
Really?
In the bee community. Yeah. That's true.
Well, I had no idea. I'd like to hear more about that. Well, if Otto was still around, maybe we wouldn't be dealing with that catastrophe. Who knows? So from ages about 4 to 8, Sylvia Plath lived in Winthrop, Massachusetts. And at age 8, her father died. Huge kind of traumatic event for her in her life. And as you can tell from the poem, she sort of spent a lot of time trying to recover and deal with his death. After her dad dies, her mother and her grandparents, they all move in together in an effort to sort of support the family. And Plath is straight A student, very involved in everything. When she's in high school, you know, at any club you can imagine, involved, getting great grades. And in August of 1950, 17 Magazine publishes her first story just after her graduation from high school. So in 1951, she goes to Smith College and wins a Mademoiselle fiction contest. And by 1952, she's starting to win major prizes, major publications. And that summer of 1952, I believe, is when she goes on... she has an internship at either Mademoiselle, during the summer. And have people heard of the book The Bell Jar?
Yes.
Okay. So that's Sylvia Plath as well. She has this internship experience, goes back, becomes suicidal, shock therapy, all that kind of stuff. A lot of which is sort of immortalized in The Bell Jar. But again, when she's not in these intense moments of depression, she's top of her class, doing really well, straight A's, all that kind of stuff. In 1955, she graduated summa cum laude and goes to Cambridge on a Fulbright, and she meets Ted Hughes there. And they get married and have 2 kids. And so Plath just continues to write and write and write like crazy, but getting more and more and more depressed this whole time. And so finally, in the winter of 1963, she and Ted Hughes, their marriage continually worsens. And winter of 1963, she's living in London in the coldest winter in I don't know how long with 2 kids. And so one morning, well before the kids get up, she turns on the gas on her stove and commits suicide. And so as you can see, she was very young when that happened. Paul Celan, on the other hand, was born November 23rd, 1920. Into a Jewish family in Romania, which was then called, I'm going to pronounce it wrong, Cernowitz? Does anybody know how to correctly pronounce it? And in 1940, Cernowitz was occupied by Soviet troops. Jews were herded into a ghetto, Celan along with them. In 1942, his parents were in an internment camp in Transnistria. His father eventually dies of typhoid there, and his mother is murdered by a shot in her neck. And that is hugely traumatic, as you can imagine. And so, sort of after that happened, his writing really kicked into full gear. He's finally conscripted for labor service in southern Moldavia. And eventually moves around and around after the war ends and finally settles in Paris and becomes a lecturer in German literature. In 1952, he gets married. His first son dies in infancy. His second son survives. And in 1970, he commits suicide by drowning. So I think it's part of, to answer your question, Martha, of why I picked these two people was, though Paul Celan survives the Holocaust and is present there, they have very, in terms of patterns of their life, there's some things that are indeed a little bit similar, which I thought was interesting. Okay, so the thing, I want to mention 2 things about Plath before we go back and look at Daddy a little bit more closely. To answer the questions about criticism and things like that, about why she was writing about the Holocaust, she, one of her big things was she was interested in double talk. And she thought, for instance, an example of double talk would be the final solution. Double talk was all these phrases that were getting used around World War II, and I bet we can think of some that are getting used now, that are ways to soften the blow of what's actually happening. So you say final solution, and that doesn't sound like, oh, we're going to slaughter thousands, millions, and millions of people. Final solution sounds like, oh, it's just the it's a solution. That sounds great. And she was witnessing the way that this sort of double talk was starting to destroy people. That by talking in that way, language can be used to justify horrible, horrible atrocities. And she wanted to take that language back. So that was part of what she was doing. Another thing was that she was born at a time, Sylvia Plath is considered a confessional poet, but she sort of arrived at a time where there were these two competing notions of poetry. The one was sort of the historical, what had been going on for many, many years, the historical idea that poetry should be mythic and transcendent. And then the other idea, which was just sort of coming up at her time, was that poetry should be involved in the present day, in what's just in front of us, in the mundane, and it should speak, and also to political stuff, but it should speak to what is happening right now. So she's a very smart woman, and she's dealing with these two very different notions of what her poetry is supposed to be doing. One is saying, you should be throwing in some mythic stuff. It should feel like this applies to all time and all places. And another group saying, no, you need to be speaking to what is happening in your political context and in your personal context right now. So I want to go through Daddy a little bit closer and see what you think about all of it. But specifically, if you see moments where it seems like she's involved in the language or involved in these competing sort of notions of poetry, we need to point those things out. Yeah, Larry.
Can you share anything more about the relationship with her dad other than that he died when she was 8? He was a biology teacher.
I'm no expert on Sylvia Plath. And mostly I went to a bunch of sites sort of devoted to her online and sort of introductions to her books and stuff like that. And it's interesting to me because there is such anger in this poem that there's not, in what I looked at, there weren't that many details that said, oh, he was this horribly abusive person, though based on reading this poem and things like that. Eunice, do you know any more about...
I don't know anything on this one in particular in terms of biographical data, except, and this is how I've always postulated it, that there was an enormous issue with the mother in latter years. I've always seen Daddy as parent. In fact, it helps when you say that she took as the mandate poetry should deal with present moments, that I don't think we know the internal or the inner relationship with the father, but perhaps as force of parent. I mean, I'm thinking of just the unleashed power of the Holocaust and for a child, the unleashed power of parent, and that's how I've seen it. So the answer is no, I don't know if there's any specific relationship with father. But there's certain, her mother burnt journals, and there was a huge issue about who was to appropriate her material of the letters with the mother. She wrote regularly when she was in England. And there was an enormous power struggle there for what she was allowed, not only while she was alive, but certainly after the death, when Ted Hughes became the executor for estate, and that went on for years. What could be... So I think that's control, power, authority.
So yes, interesting, because Daddy is both
as a lawyer and just one parent.
Interesting. Well, let's just go back and look at some of the stuff. And people can, we'll start here at the first stanza, but just anything you notice about these issues, also just, you know, how is this written, especially in comparison to deaf view, how it looks on the page, the sorts of techniques she might be using. You do not do any more black shoe in which I have lived like a foot for 30 years, poor and white,
barely daring to breathe or achoo. What strikes you, just sort of poetically or otherwise?
Is the black shoe her depression, her mental state?
What do you think?
Obviously, that's what I think. Don't ask, tell.
Sounds a little like Prufrock. I dare not do.
Great, that sort of the repetition. Yep.
Incredible confinement. The foot in the shoe, and I can't even breathe or sneeze. Mm-hmm. I'm so confined.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And I think,
have you seen any readings of it being totally depression through? That's really because she is there, but. She dies in 63, right? And this is
right before. Yeah.
And that's just what is she when she dies? Like 31?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this was written what year?
I think this was in the book directly before. It says October, November of 1962, right after her separation from Ted Hughes. All of the Holocaust references made in her poetry come at that time. So all the Holocaust references come the last couple months of her life, right after she separated from her husband. So I think the depression thing in there for sure.
This was not an amicable separation either.
No.
You asked earlier about, or somebody asked about, what the relationship with the father was. That very next line kind of indicates to me that maybe the black shoe, wasn't necessarily a negative force. But Daddy, I had to kill you, to put you off my mind, mm-hmm. and then this depression kind of takes over. I see that line as maybe he wasn't. You died before I had time. In other words, you died obliterated, and she's always coming down.
Yeah. No, that's great, because those two lines are so ambiguous in the sense of you died before I had time to kill you, but also you died before I had time to have a relationship with you, and that, you know, that both are inherent in those two lines. Yeah. And how about just in terms of comparing this to Celan's sort of long, lingering lines without punctuation and things like that, what do you notice about how this poem is arranged? Just what kind of poetic devices are you seeing?
It's more staccato, more choppy.
Yes.
Just bullet points.
Yes. Great.
So the thoughts are each separate sort of thought.
Yes.
Instead of the same thing, but. Yeah. Geographically and through her mind.
Yeah.
Why did she pick the Holocaust?
Why do you think?
Well, I'm having a hard time. She did not have any direct connection to the Holocaust. Her father didn't.
I can tell you that in an interview, I'll read you her interview statement about that, because it is maybe good to hear in her own words. When asked why she treats the Holocaust in her poetry, she declares, "In particular, my background is, may I say, German and Austrian, and so my concern with concentration camps and so on is uniquely intense. And then, again, I'm rather a political person as well, so I suppose that's what part of it comes from." One might add, as James Young argues, that she also felt she shared the era of victimhood, victimized by modern life at large as the Jews and Japanese have been victimized by specific events in modern life. So, is that kind of... I think she, at a very real level, because she was Austrian and had that heritage, and I think felt, you know, as somebody who's part of those who were the aggressors, what's my part? What do I do? How do I take on this history? Which brings up back to the idea of who gets to write about this. Is it only the victims in a conflict that get to tell their story, or do we permit the aggressors to tell theirs as well?
William Styron has a great line in Sophie's Choice that says, the subject, it's about the Holocaust, the subject, he's not Jewish, the subject remains impenetrable only so long as we fail, to try to penetrate it. And he feels it gives him the right to do that. But another thing, not quite on the level of Steyer, is I had a student once make this analogy. She was an animal rights person, and her sentence was something like this. They packed those dogs in there like Jews in a car going to Auschwitz. And I said, you can't do that. And she didn't get it. But there's two comparisons there. One is, you can't do that, can you? Does that make sense?
I don't know, but that's the exact question we're asking here. Can you do that?
Well, that's very different.
Why?
Because, well, it isn't different from Plath. No, it's different from Steyer, maybe.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess I felt that reading this, that, you know, Sylvia, I'm sorry, you had a tough life, and I read a little bit about it, too. But you can't do that.
Okay.
I think she's doing personal here. I think my personal life is being, I think it has to do with power and subjection. It's put into a person, obviously, but I'm not sure she's saying me and Daddy are such a, I don't know.
Well, yeah, I think, yeah.
Because it's certainly, I think, you're bringing up that it's often very much read as a confession of peace about her relationship with her father. And if that's true, then is it legitimate to compare that relationship to this? On the other hand, you're just saying, but what if this is at a greater level a piece about authority and, you know, the relationship of being subjected to authority of all different kinds, then is it legitimate to bring in all examples of that? I don't know.
Could it be her depression was speaking through here? I mean, she's feeling that as such a persecution type of thing that is just, you know, controlling her life, and somehow she's able to identify with what she has heard or read about Nazi Germany and.
Okay, so the victiming might be depression as well as relational, so relationship to self. And I think, let me read another quote, because I think this is interesting too. Because I think sometimes we forget that, you know, being a female poet at that time was a really hard thing to do. And we've come a long way since then, and maybe we forget, but when she was 17 years old, here's an entry from a journal. "I am afraid of getting older," wrote the 17-year-old Sylvia Plath in 1949. "I am afraid of getting married. Spare me from cooking 3 meals a day. Spare me from the relentless cage of routine and rote. I want to be free. I want, I think, to be omniscient. Yet if I were not in this body, where would I be? Perhaps I am destined to be classified and qualified, but oh, I cry out against it. I am powerful, but to what extent I am I?" So I think, you know, depression is certainly real, but much of that depression was circumstantial too, you know, it was what the life that she was born into having to sort of fulfill too, so not to forget that.
Yeah, where did you go from there? Wasn't just, I think their Jewish Beth was Jewish, wasn't she?
I don't think she was.
I don't think she was.
No, I don't think she was. No.
She talked about that quote sounds like my sister that I just about cried.
You what?
That quote sounds much like my sister that I was crying. You couldn't be an independent woman. It just wasn't allowed.
No.
The other thing here is that we can debate all day whether she had a right to do it. She did it.
Right.
Yep.
And therefore...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the question at some level isn't, well, can writers do this?
Right.
Because too bad for us. You know, like, whatever, it's going to happen. But the question then becomes, well... The question, I think, becomes a lot as you're bringing up how is it done and how is legitimate. There's two kinds of
stuff. Yeah. I was going to say that does it somehow appropriate an experience that then accrues to the individual appropriating it in a way, or does this somehow convey
would say is a universal truth about depression, oppression, just the blackness that we all experience. Now, I feel pretty good about this poem, and but then the other question is, what did Jewish folks at the time say? And I don't know that, and I would tend to listen, even though I'm fine with the poem. I think it's conveyed some kind of, well, and the fact that, you know, he's reminded of his sister, and there's a universal reality or truth that this taps us into, and so I think that's a service, or that's a gift that's been offered. And so I don't think it's abused the image. It's used it in a way that can help.
Don't we do that quite a bit? Well, I mean, you take a look at like the Holocaust and whether or not she has the right to write about it. What about, I mean, that's because the time frame is closer to what we're living in now. Take a look at the Bible. Do theologians have the right to interpret and look at the Bible? That, you know, I mean, they did not live back in the time of Christ, so.
Well, I hope so.
I've been
sinning.
So, I mean, I think that she would have just as much of a right to try and see what that means to her as we as Christians have to look at the Bible stories and figure out what they mean.
Was there not?
Larry says, yes.
I think there are two different issues. One is the question of trivialization. And the illustration you gave, I think that's another illustration of the problem that we can trivialize by making comparisons with the Holocaust, because it was such a monstrous thing. On the other hand, the victimization is a very human experience. And to say only this one people can talk about victimization as human beings, I don't think it's legitimate. They certainly have a right to talk about victimization, but they're not the only victims.
Are there, one thing that strikes me is that Salon lived through it.
Mm-hmm.
It's one thing to say that you were a Jew or you were this or you were this, but if you've got a time frame that changed circumstances. And I think it's one thing to say, okay, Salon speaks with an authority of having lived it. It's not just something that he thought about two generations later. And it would be interesting to see if there are other poets who are younger, and to see what their take or how they would compare. In other words, they're a generation or two later, not having lived through it, but as a group, having learned things or experienced things, but still not the same as Salon. I mean, Salon rings through. I mean, you've been there, you've walked in the shoes, then you got to really say, yeah, he's legitimate. But if whether or not Plath was Jewish or not Jewish, but has some universal feelings, I...
But it can be a slippery slope with literature, because as soon as you start playing the game of... To write something that is true or rings true, you have to be that gender or have lived in that place or been through that time or whatever. Suddenly we don't have fiction anymore. We only have nonfiction. It goes away. And so, but at the same time, like, do I want to read a poem in which George Bush speaks in the voice of a black single mother? You know, I mean,
I wish,
right, but yeah, maybe that would be a great experience, you know? Paul, what were you going to say?
Well, I love your statement of the trivialization process, and I don't think this trivializes it, and I don't think she's wrong in doing it, I don't think she's wrong in taking it on, and I think it's the nature of art, whether poetry or fiction, or, yeah, those two. To how do you explain something so inexplicable?
Yeah.
How do you create some sense of connection or understanding? I read one theologian that said, when you look at the Holocaust, all theology goes out the window. There's no way to explain. So what can you do other than identify a personal story that it isn't historical, but it's true.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking specifically of these lines. You stand at the blackboard, Danny, and the picture I have of you, a cleft in your chin instead of your foot. I don't know if that means these are cloven hoof and of evil, but she's got a connection to evil that she can identify with, but she can't possibly identify with the evil of the Holocaust. So she's made a connection that then sets us up for that, doing the same kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that it, by making the connection, it paves the way for us to at least have some sort of access into something that before has seemed completely inaccessible.
Yeah, is it possible for a man to ever understand a woman? Of course. Or vice versa. Can William Steyer write a novel about a woman? Mm-hmm. He did.
Not to mention the editor.
Something about the spa that reading it is very hard, the whole thing, because something she has done there has captured the breathless inability to free oneself. I'm trying reading it aloud. It's very hard, I think. I don't know if it's hard to listen to the first time. The first time I ever read it, I was terrified of what the language made me feel, which is a place of being utterly loath, also compressed, confined. Inescapable. And somehow she does that, and that's one of the miracles of language, that in that tight little lines, you've got the scream of for release, I think. Can I throw a monkey wrench in this business of who can help tell whose story better? I don't know what it's like here. 20 years ago, we had this famous novel in Canada called Temptations of Big Bear, and a white famous novelist, non-native, had told the story, and he was much applauded for finally telling the last chief to sign a treaty. And then within 20 years, slowly eroding the respect that a white person had written the native side of the story, and it's a constant circle, I think, between who can tell whose story. Mm-hmm. He opened the gates to that story being told. On the other hand, now it's almost take that off the syllabus and put on the texts that have been written by the native people themselves, which is kind of an extreme reaction. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I don't know if this exists here, but it's who can appropriate whose story. Can he tell the story from Big Bear's point of view? Historically, he did it really well, but it certainly opened the floodgates for the discussion, which is not dissimilar, I think, to this.
Right, from this. And I think, and maybe we'll sort of, obviously it's a conversation that can go on for quite a while, and it's good, I think, if it does continue and outside of here, and I'm certainly glad to keep engaging in it. I feel bad because sort of what I think you're getting at, Eunice, is, and all of this is kind of, you know, this how is the person presenting the material? And in the case of that book, it's not so much that he did it, but did he do it in the best way possible? And maybe another book comes along later that does it better. And so then the question, there's a reliance on us as readers to look really closely at the material and not just, oh, she threw in some things about the Holocaust, maybe that's ridiculous and it trivializes it, so I'm going to throw away the thing. But starting to look at, but how is she doing as a poet in this? And kind of what you were saying, we didn't get to as much as I wanted to, but, you know, that there's a lot of rhyme in here. It almost begins to have a nursery rhyme-like feel. What's that doing? How is that working against the content? Things like, And the fact that it's all stanzas of five lines, which anytime you have an odd number of lines kind of throws you off base a little way. Couplets or quatrains, two or four lines, have a nice balanced feel. Three or five, there's always something a little bit off balance about that. So really going through and paying good attention, not just to the content of what some of the words that are in there, but really how is this person going at this? And Paul gave a great example of in the case where it's just sort of a student throwing off a metaphor in the middle of a nonfiction piece. that maybe that's not such an appropriate treatment of it, you know? And maybe this isn't either, but as Eunice was saying, it maybe is opening the door, giving us, like Paul was saying, an accessible route to begin talking about this huge thing. And it might not be the best route. We might find other paths that are going to be better or more accurate, but it's a beginning. And so, you know, as we keep writing and to keep reading, think about, you know, what is the quality of what we're reading in terms of how it gives us accessibility to those things. Thank you all for coming so much, and let's continue the discussion.